Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. This is a study of the brutal torture and murder of the author's brother and his longtime girlfriend 40 years ago. In July 1978, two bodies were found in the sea off the coast of Guatemala and proved to be the remains of Chris Farmer and Peter Frampton, respectively a medical graduate and a law graduate, aged 25 and 24 from Greater Manchester. They had been beaten, tortured, and killed, their bodies weighted down and dumped in the sea from the yacht in which they had been crewing. For nearly 40 years, no one is charged with these savage murders, even though the name of the yacht, the Justin B., and its owner, an American named Silas Boston, were known. But this is also the story of how Chris's sister, Penny Farmer, and her family tracked down the killer and assembled the evidence against him until eventually in December 2016, Boston was arrested in the United States and charged with two counts of maritime murder. He pleaded not guilty, but among the evidence that Chris Farmer's family, aided by police forces in both the UK and the United States, as well as the FBI, had so patiently collected, was the eyewitness testimony of one of Boston's two sons, who aged 13 and 12, had been present when the murders took place. Regrettably, Boston will now never face justice, for he effectively took his own life in prison in April 2017. But for the families of Chris and PETA, they have at least the satisfaction of knowing that through their own efforts over many years, their killer did not escape being made to face his crimes. The book we're featuring this evening is Dead in the Water, Bringing Down My Brother's Keeper After 39 Years on the Run. My special guest, journalist and author, all the way from the United Kingdom, Penny Farmer. Thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, and welcome to the program, Penny Farmer.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's start off, because we have so much to cover in this incredible tale, much, much stranger than fiction. Let's talk about your family, your mom, Audrey, and your dad, Charles, your brother, Nigel, and then your brother, Chris. Tell us a little bit about your family in 1978. How old were you? Tell us a little bit about where your family lived. Tell us a little bit about your life with your brother, Chris Farmer.
Okay, we were quite an ordinary family, really. That we were, there were the three of us and mum and dad, and we grew up in a suburb of Manchester called Chorlton, which really doesn't have much to recommend it, but apart from the fact that it's where the Bee Gees came from and the Monkees. You know, it was quite a happening time music-wise. George Best, the footballer, came from Manchester, so. So in that respect, it was a happening place. But Chorlton, the suburb where we grew up, was pretty sort of quiet and a sleepy sort of little, sort of town. But my brother, my two brothers were older than me. I was 17 when Chris he was a medical student, and he and Peter had started dating when they were age 14. They were childhood sweethearts, and she literally lived opposite us in the same road. And whereas a lot of relationships tend to fall by the wayside, theirs lasted, and Chris turned down Oxbridge, Cambridge and Oxford University, to go to a university which she could get into as well. So, I mean, that was a measure of the strength of their relationship. So, it was a fairly normal upbringing, really. My older brother was another 8 years older than me. It was, a good, happy family. We loved sailing and going on seaside holidays every year to a place called Anglesey, which is just off Wales. It was a very happy upbringing.
You talked about your father being in working for the BBC, and also that it was a very good time, very good family life that you had. Also that you went to this family holidays on the island of Anglesey, but there was this love of fishing and sailing. And also, Chris, you talk about the happening Manchester in the 60s. Tell us about Chris's character in particular. Not only did he like sailing and fishing, but he had his mind set up, you say, at 10 years old, what he wanted to do in his life. So tell us a little bit more about Chris specifically and some of the things that made up his character.
Yeah, I mean, he was quite a character, quite a big character. I mean, one of the nicest things about writing the book has been the number of friends of his, that some of which we didn't even know from his, university days, have come forward and given us, their accounts and memories of him. And one thing that just really strikes me, I mean, we always knew that, he was a very, outgoing, a big personality. I mean, what one of his friends described him as probably, the biggest character in their university year, the most charming, the most charismatic. At the same time, he was a very dedicated doctor, junior doctor. He was, absolutely driven to becoming. He wanted to become a surgeon. He was very trusting, probably, perhaps too trusting in retrospect. Although, I don't think so actually, because. Well, we'll go on to the story, the development of the story. He was just a really kind soul, as was Peter. That they were just two very decent human beings. Chris was, a colourful character, very, very popular, and they had friends from all walks of life, not just from medicine and from law. They just made friends very easily, and when they went to university, they were quite well known for having parties and, a wide circle of friends.
Go to 1978 and talk about their love of travel, both of them, and they have an opportunity through this after-hours medical service in Brisbane, Australia, and are recruiting British doctors for 3-month contracts. Tell us what... PETA and Chris's plan, your brother's plan was, which included this trip to Brisbane.
Okay, yeah, they had always enjoyed traveling and had gone to Morocco and various places in Europe, when they were at university and indeed during their school years. And obviously doing medicine and law, they're pretty lengthy periods of study, so they'd always held this joint ambition of travelling for around about a year. And this job offer came up in Australia, in Brisbane and along the Golden Coast down there, for Chris to do this after-hours medical work. So they went over, and they spent about 6 months over there, really enjoying the outdoor lifestyle, and sailing again, and fishing and swimming. And Peter got a job, just a sort of menial secretarial job, whilst Chris worked out of hours, a medical job. And by all accounts, they kept in such good contact with us. They wrote, Peter wrote very long, very, very descriptive letters back home to her mother. And Chris always kept in touch by sending cassette tapes that he'd recorded and sending those back to us. So, I don't think there was a week that went by where we didn't actually hear from one of them. So, we got a very good idea of what they were doing, and it was just good to keep in touch with them.
Right. Now, there was a plan to start traveling down through Mexico and explore some islands, and they had gone to Caledonia and Fiji, and they wanted to look at some, explore Mayan and Aztec ruins in Mexico. So tell us about this plan to travel into Mexico with a couple.
So, yeah, so they landed in Los Angeles and didn't really like the city, the urban, you know, side of Los Angeles, and decided they wanted to get out and go south of the border. So they got a coach. I think they hired a car down to the border, and then they got a coach down to Oaxaca. And they spent a good couple of weeks looking around the Aztec ruins and, you know, all the historical sites. But then they met a couple who had, you know, because they loved the sea and the outdoorsy life, this couple had said that there was a Great Barrier Reef on, you know, skirting the Belizean border, and had recommended to them to go there. So their plans changed, and one of the notable features of the case is that, you know, it was just literally that they were changing their plans day by day. And, you know, you read the story and you think, oh, my goodness, if only they hadn't done that. You know, it's literally hours away from them changing their plans or it being a very different outcome.
You talk about the extensive long letters that PETA sent to her mother, Sammy. This one was June 6th, 1978. What, as you mentioned, they said that they were on their way to Belize, and they had stopped in Chechimo on the east coast of Yucatan Peninsula. But tell us what else they said in that letter.
So they'd met some British soldiers, and that they'd spent the evening drinking with them, and they had said that they'd actually rather be in Ireland because there was more excitement there, and PETA couldn't understand that, you know, why they would want to put themselves in danger. But Chechumal is very much the sort of gateway to Belize, and they were looking forward to going to Belize and exploring.
There was you mentioned the owner of the Norma boat and his Australian girlfriend, and they introduced Chris and to an American acquaintance of theirs named Silas Duane Boston. They said they'd spent a couple months sailing to different islands with them, snorkeling and swimming, fishing, and with another friend, Brian, as well. And that Duane Boston was, as you write, was a well-known character in Belize. So tell us a little bit more about this meeting, how they met Duane Boston, and then what is written in the letter in terms of their plans regarding Duane Boston.
Yes, so they had, Duane Boston was operating this, he was a Californian from Sacramento, and they met him just by chance through another couple, the owners of the Norma, and they decided to do some sailing with him and go out to these beautiful keys and islands that literally litter that coastline. And it was, he ran this sort of, if you like, ferry service, really, between the Keys and the islands, and gave tourists, such as Chris and PETA, lifts to the islands. And it wasn't long before he discovered that the most enjoyable part for the tourists was dropping off at various keys and barbecuing the fish of the day, the catch of the day, and sort of making a bit more of a sort of a party of it, you know, a sort of day excursion. And so he was running that sort of service. And obviously Chris and PETA had experienced this and felt that, you know, that they enjoyed it. It was, you know, as I say, Chris was a great sailor because he'd enjoyed sailing and learnt to be a very good sailor from when we used to go on holidays as a family to Anglesey. But they decided it was, you know, that part of it that they wanted to continue with, and for it to be a longer journey rather than just a day trip.
Right. As you write in the book, though, the this is a new business for Boston, and he has no license to trade, so he uses that this fishing boat, basically, or a bigger boat, anyway, six-ton boat, to sail tourists, like you say, to one of the Keys, or to ferry them to Belize City. But you say that right after about 3 months of business, that officials boarded his boat and told him what? What did they tell him?
They told him that he didn't have a license to trade and he was actually taking business away from the locals. And they told him to get out of the area, either that or to become an official ferry operator, which obviously he didn't want to do because, as we were to find out, he was actually on the run from California, and he was evading law enforcement. So he obviously didn't want to come up on the radar, and the whole reason he was down there was he was hiding away from law enforcement in Sacramento.
He had also told the previous passengers that he was going to sell this boat, and you write that the history of this boat is that when he first went over that border with his sons, Russell and Vince, 12 and 13 years of age, he had sold his guns, you write, and he had crossed the border. Mm-hmm. And when he was with these passengers, there was talk, wasn't there, of him selling this boat, and then especially after his conversation with the Belize officials.
Yes, he said he was going to take the boat further south, down to Costa Rica, and to sell it. And it was at that point, because Chris was on the way to another medical job in Trinidad, and Peter was going to spend some time with another medical friend of theirs in Louisiana, so that they decided that they would go with Boston down the coast, and Chris would get the sailing experience that he really wanted, and then they would part company with him in Honduras.
Now, you say even though they're part of the crew, Chris is an experienced sailor, and this is a business for this Dwayne Boston. So what is the deal that they strike up? What are the particulars of the deal, and how much is Boston charging Chris and PETA for this trip?
Okay, he was charging them $500 each, which at the time seemed quite a lot. It seemed quite a lot of money, bearing in mind that they were both taken on as crew. We only have his word for that. And in retrospect, it might be that he increased that amount because ultimately he was to rob them of their money. So we only have his word for that.
Now, you talk about the letters from PETA to her mother, Sammy, and the contact that you have with Chris. When is the last time you hear from Chris, and is there anything out of the ordinary, anything untoward in that the last letter from PETA to her mother and or the conversation you have or you get recorded from Chris?
So he called us from Oaxaca in Mexico, and it was a perfectly, happy conversation. He also sent us a tape recording, he was looking forward to exploring Mexico further. At that point, they hadn't decided to go to Belize when we heard from him in the tape. We heard from Peter. We got a letter in early June, but then what happened was there was nothing. We didn't hear. There was complete radio silence and no letters, no communication at all throughout July. And it was at that point we really started worrying. Then we got a letter, I think it was August the 4th, from Peter. And if she posted a letter late, she always added a postscript. Never failed. She always said, I haven't been able to post this letter, so I'm adding a little bit extra to now to tell you exactly where I am. She was so good at keeping in touch in that way. And we received a letter on August the 4th, which was which was dated, which had a post stamp, had been posted on July the 18th. And the last mention in the letter was June the 29th, and they were at Hunting Key in the southern part of Belize. And it had been right. posted from Livingston in Guatemala.
You write, too, that in this letter, again, everything is much more meaningful later once you realize about their disappearance. But in this letter, she talks about the kids that are 12 and 13 acting like 8-year-olds. And she talks about
yeah.
that, she comments that it's she's had enough of primitive living and that the space is certainly not enough for 5 people. So you write
yeah.
that there's a different tone in that letter from all the other letters that she's ever written.
Yes, I mean, at the beginning of the letter, which was written, I think, sort of about June 28th, you know, she what one senses is that they had enjoyed the bohemian lifestyle and, the sea life. But then the mood music of the letter changes, and by the postscript of the 29th, she talks about the boys being very fractious and Boston losing his temper with the boys a lot. And one senses that the small cabin where they were sleeping was getting her down. It was very primitive. And one senses that things were going awry at that point.
Now, you say that there's mounting anxiety within your family and the Frampton family as well. Tell us by the end of August what this anxiety is a result. What do you guys do as a result? What do the two families do?
Well, my parents, my father being a BBC journalist, he made an incredible amount of inquiries himself. And my mother wrote letters. I don't think there was any embassy in Central or South America that didn't receive a letter from them asking if they knew the whereabouts of Chris and Peter. They wrote copious letters. They sent photographs. They then contacted the Foreign Office, who likewise made various inquiries. They went on television to make an appeal to see if anybody had returned recently from that area of Central America who could perhaps help, who maybe had seen them. They just didn't leave any stone unturned. And then my father had an absolute brainwave. He contacted the harbour masters in Dangriga, which from Peter's letter we knew was the last major port along the Belizean coast that the boat had left from. And it was that was to prove crucial evidence both back in the 70s but also in the latter day investigation, because what that proved was that Chris and Peter were signed on as crew on the Justin B in June from Dangriga. So we knew that they were on that boat and they had left port. And then he also contacted the harbour master in Guatemala, because Peter's letter had said that their plans again had changed and that they were going to be probably dropped off in Guatemala because the weather wasn't good and to sail further down to Honduras would be difficult, and that Boston was going to put them ashore in Guatemala. So my father and mother contacted the harbour master in Livingston, and apparently the boat had put in, but without Chris and Peter on board. So we knew that whatever had happened to them had happened out at sea and off the Belizean coast.
Also, the captain of that local boat, they knew, was an American named Silas Duane Boston. They knew the name.
Yeah.
You had
yes.
the name.
Yeah, I mean, extraordinarily, you know, the amount of detail that Peter put in her letters, you know, she had even put his name, his age. She'd put the ages of the two boys and their names. You know, it was quite incredible, really, just how much, you know, detail we had.
Now, despite this horror and this this disaster that's unfolding, your parents and your entire family keep it together to launch their own, essentially their own investigation, or do as much aiding the authorities as you possibly can. You talk about mid-October, and I know that we're skipping over all the time that your family is distraught. But mid-October, you receive a call from the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, and they say that Boston's two sons are found, the two sons that were accompanying him on this trip.
Well, what happened in October... by the way, if I could just go back slightly, you know, when I was saying that Chris was a very trusting character, because you might think, well, why did they get on this boat with a stranger? However, Boston was a very charismatic, very, by all accounts, very warm character. And, of course, at the end of the day, he had two young sons with him. One looks at their photograph and they're two very angelic little boys. So, you know, you would think you're safe, wouldn't you? With a father with two young boys, mm-hmm. You would never think that this was some bad guy. But anyway, just to go back to your question. So in October, we were to discover, because by this time, you know, my parents had put out inquiries left, right and center. But we found that Boston had come back onto the radar. What had happened was he'd taken the boat back up north, back up the Belizean coast, and sold the boat, and had then flown very, very quickly. He'd got out of the country, flown to Miami, and then taken a car, a coach, and then a hire car back to Sacramento. So he was back on the radar again, and we were absolutely delighted at this point, thinking, right, we're going to find out where they are now, you know, we're going to get some information. And so the British consul in San Francisco interviewed him, but first by phone and then in person, and he brought along with him his father, Russell Sr., and they interviewed him quite extensively. But of course, they weren't a law enforcement agency, but their hunch was, when they mentioned, where's Chris and Peter, what did you do, you know, where did you put them down, where did they disembark, apparently his whole demeanor, his whole body language was such that he looked guilty, that they were left with no doubt that this was a guilty guy.
Right. Now, what you say that the family expects something like someone to look for the sons for normal investigation to proceed. What does happen?
So... we basically what then happened was, you know, Russell and Vince, the two boys, were passed from pillar to post between the two divorced grandparents and Boston himself. Because the British consul was alerted to the fact that they felt he was guilty, they then transferred the case to Sacramento police, who had him in for it, or wanted to have him in for interviewing. The sheriff apparently was very keen to speak to him, and I think did on a couple of occasions. He was interviewed by the police. And then, quite extraordinarily, because ultimately, but by December, we ourselves had put the case in Manchester, in the hands of Greater Manchester Police. They asked Sacramento Police to interview him as well. They made a request. But my father, being a journalist, managed to track Boston and his father, the grandfather, down and get a phone number for him. Well, at that time in 1978, Greater Manchester Police weren't able to make international calls. And I know it sounds extraordinary, but this is the different world that we used to live in those days. Jeez. You know, no mobile phones, and the police couldn't make international phone calls. So my father, with the agreement of the police, rang Boston and got his father on the phone. And put a load of questions to him, and then said to his father, please, we need to speak to Boston himself. So one day, out of the blue, in January 1979, Boston rang my father and basically came up with a bunch of lies. And quite tellingly, the story then had begun to change. He told them that he had put them ashore near Puerto Barrios in Guatemala, and you know the story had slight subtle differences, so it wasn't a solid story that he was telling.
And as a journalist, being a former journalist, your father recorded that conversation for further
use.
He
did with his father, but unfortunately, because Boston himself had caught my father unawares, because my father said, you know, please ask your son to ring us, and we will, you know, buy collect, and we will pay the for the call. He rang him in the middle of the night, and he didn't have the recorder going when Boston rang him. So unfortunately, that call wasn't recorded. But my father did write notes and, you know, transcribed everything.
Mm-hmm. You talk about...
By January, you see, we were still no further in knowing where they were, and my parents were literally, you know, aging in front of us, my elder brother and I, and, you know, it was terrible. By then, they had been missing since July of the previous year. By January, you know, we just didn't know what to do. They were missing. No one was telling us anything. Boston was coming up with this changing story all the time. And so my parents at that point decided to employ a private detective, which was a friend of another doctor who Peter was going to visit in Louisiana. He had a Belizean friend who we employed as a private detective to look in just about all the tourist haunts that he could think of along the Belizean coast to see if he could get any information on the case and try to push the case forward, because nobody was doing anything. Greater Manchester Police had never dealt with an international case of this sort. Sacramento police just didn't really know what to do and said, well, it's not our jurisdiction. It happened in Guatemala. They just didn't know what to do. And by spring of 1979, you know, some 10 months on, Boston then went on the run. And he was literally running up and down with sometimes the two children, the Californian coast, down over the Mexican border to Baja, hiding out down there. Whenever he felt he was hot, which meant, you know, the police were on his trail, he just disappeared. And, you know, the grandparents colluded in all of this. They hid the boys whenever anybody tried to interview them. You know, we pretty much knew who this guy was, you know, that he was guilty as hell, but we just couldn't track him down. Nobody was doing anything. So, as I say, at a point of desperation, my parents employed this private detective.
Yes. This is Alfonso de Pina. We're going to go ahead to January 1979. You talk about a major breakthrough via this Alfonso de Pina. He meets a Catholic priest. What does this Catholic priest, Father Jerry, what story does he tell him?
I mean, Alfonso was visiting hotels, cemeteries, you know, churches, ports, and he met this Catholic priest just by pure chance, and he said, you know, have you heard of these two people, these two British, you know, young people? And he said, well, he said, I haven't heard of them, but I do know that two Westerners were buried, were washed ashore. Well, they weren't washed ashore. They were found about 200 meters off the peninsula off Guatemala. Punta de la Cabo Peninsula. And he said that this happened back in July of 1978. Remember that this was in January of 1979. So he said, right, you know, 7 months previous, two bodies had been found floating offshore, weighed down with motor engine parts, and they from which they had come loose. The ropes had come loose. Their bodies had bloated, and they had come to the surface, and they had, well, the female had a plastic bag round her neck and placed over her head, and they'd obviously shown signs of torture. And he said that they were brought ashore, as were the engine parts to which their bodies were tied, which were at the bottom of the sea, and they were brought ashore, and an autopsy was done on them, and then they were buried and identified in the cemetery in Puerto Barrios, and they were buried in unidentified graves in a corner of the cemetery. He didn't want to break the news to us, because obviously that was devastating news, but he did tell the Foreign Office, who then informed us. But even then, we still didn't know conclusively that it was them. I mean, we had a pretty good idea, two Westerners in that locality. You know, we were pretty sure that these must have been, you know, Chris and Peter. But then we had to wait a further 2 months, because we had to have their dental records flown out and their bodies exhumed. And such was the shambolic state of the cemetery, they had to dig up six other bodies before they found Chris and Peter. And, you know, very, very sadly and tragically, their dental records matched. So it was then April that we actually knew that they were dead, and we obviously knew the circumstances of their death, but we had no idea why it had happened. These were two very decent human beings, kind, you know, responsible, worthwhile human beings who had died in the most ghastly, heinous way, and we had to live with that for 38 years. We had a pretty good idea who had killed them, but we knew nothing about why they had ended up in that state. And that was the wreckage that we came to live with for 38 years.
Before this case goes completely cold and you revisit it back in 2015, you have this epiphany, as you write. Do you think after this, when the bodies have been exhumed and you've gone through this laborious effort to find them in the first place, and this by chance meeting of this priest to tell you this incredibly sad story that offers no closure whatsoever, do you believe, you contact Greater Manchester Police, there's a Sacramento Police Department, do you think there's hope at that point that something can be resolved after finding out all this information?
Well, no, not really. I mean, it's hard to imagine just how lost we felt. You know, my parents were just operating in a bubble, really, that this, you know, it all seemed so remote. Nobody was talking to us. Nobody was really contacting us. We had so little help. The little amount of information we did have was really only gleaned by my parents. Nobody else really helped us. The detective who was working on the case in Greater Manchester was 10 months later moved on to other duties. And, you know, we had, because, you know, international communication was so poor in those days, it was terrible, really. I mean, I think we waited a further 18 months, not hearing anything, only that we were told that Boston had gone on the run, the children couldn't be found. But we did get one glimmer of hope where we really did think the case was at last go forward. And that was in 1981, when Boston turned up on the radar again, because he was wanted for the abduction of one of his children, not the two children who were on board the boat. It was right. One of his other children. And he was wanted for the abduction of that child. And we were told about this, and we thought, great, you know, we're back on track again. We're going to hear something now, because you know, obviously, they were the file for Chris and Peter was still open, and also we were led to believe, and we do know that he was interviewed about Chris and Peter again, but again, the story was changing again subtly, you know, that his lies were becoming more and more, you know, he was telling more and more lies, shall we say.
One of the characters in this book that couldn't let this case go was C.I. David Sachs, and he'd been moved off the case, like you had said, but he wrote a letter to the San Rafael Police Department saying that your father was a journalist and a med student and a highly intelligent guy that could be an asset in this investigation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, my father was just, you know, he was obsessed with it, really. You know, I think people, when they find themselves in this situation, either go, you know, one of two ways. And, you know, my parents, they're very, I say my parents, that my father's now dead. He died in 2013, sadly, never knowing any of this. He died, you know, not knowing what happened to Chris. But for my mother as well, she's very sort of stiff British upper lip, and they just threw themselves into the investigation. They never gave up, you know. Even I think, as you know, as far as 2001, they were still, you know, once the internet was around, they were emailing Sacramento Police Department saying, you know, we lost our son and his girlfriend in Guatemala. You know, we pretty much know who did it. Has he come back on the scene? Has he been charged with any other crimes? You know, but we never heard anything. And as I say, when Boston did come back on the radar again in 1981, he was let off on a technicality for the abduction of this child. And once again, you know, he flew like a bird released from its cage, and once again, you know, went on the run. And, you know, they couldn't pin Chris. I think, you know, the guy who interviewed, the detective who interviewed him, you know, he did ask him all the pertinent questions, but of course with no clear evidence, you know, because all the evidence had been lost, the engine parts, etc., had been lost, and because it happened in Guatemalan waters, it was British citizens, and this, the you know, the suspect was American, Californian. It was just too difficult for anybody to push ahead and prosecute, and it just completely floundered. I think everybody just felt this was too hard an international case to ever solve. So sadly, again, in 1981, he went on the run, and, you know, we completely lost all hope of ever getting any answers.
You write that you graduated English literature degree, Lancaster University, and you moved to London in 1982, studying to be a journalist, and you did become a journalist. You met your husband to be, Ben, in 1987. You were married the next year, and you had a child in 1990. You moved to Oxford, gave up working in London, and worked for a local paper, and was a PR consultant. You had two more kids in 93 and 96. Again, you say in 1991, your mother wrote Sacramento Police Department, any news? No reply. Fast forward to October 2nd, 2015. You're in at home. Tell us about that day and this epiphany, as you write.
So, I mean, Chris has always been a part of our lives. We've never forgotten him. And, you know, Mum and I, my mother lives with us. She's now 94, but she's, you know, she's got all her marbles, and she's, you know, she's very fluent. She's physically very active still. And so she and I were out on the dog walk. It was a beautiful autumn's day. And, you know, we were sitting in this field, and you know, as quite often it does, we got round to talking about Chris, and my mum said, you know, I wonder what he'd have looked like now. You know, he would have been in his 60s. You know, and it was at that point, really, it was just really like a bolt from the blue. I just thought, my goodness, why on earth have I not looked for Boston and these two boys, well, obviously men by then, but two boys on the internet. You know, times have changed, times have moved on. Why have I not done this before? So I literally raced home from this, you know, from this dog walk, and I went to my mum's bureau, and she and dad had compiled a huge portfolio of documents, much of it with original documentation in it, back from the 1970s. And so I got it all out, and I literally just that evening, I sort of drilled down and looked for anything I could associated with the family, and it actually didn't take very long to find the two sons first. I found Russell Boston, and then I found Vince, and then I, you know, discovered Boston himself. And you know, my jaw was on the floor at this point. I just thought, my goodness, what, you know, these are the three people that we have for the last 38 years needed and wanted to track, and here they are in front of me in glorious Technicolor, living what seemed to be very happy, very normal lives. And yeah, so I literally spent that whole weekend compiling a sort of profile of the three of them, and then I, you know, I went. I mean, it's amazing, really, how much you can find out on Facebook, how much people give away unwittingly. So I, you know, I was writing copious notes at this point, and then I, you know, extended my research further out, and I could see that Vince had lodged an appeal in 2012 for information about his mother. I could see from his Facebook that he knew that his mother had died from a gunshot wound, because he was decrying the American gun laws, and he was saying, you know, that his mother had been shot at the age of 23 back in 1968, and I was just amazed that ought to find all this information. We knew back in 1979 that Boston's wife had gone missing 10 years or 11 years previous. So, but we didn't really know any more detail. We knew that the boy's mother, Boston's wife, I think it was his third wife, had gone missing, but we didn't really know any more. I think the supposition was that she had been killed, but we didn't know any more detail. So in 2015, to find that detail on the internet, on Facebook, was just extraordinary.
You took this effort to, and you must have been encouraged by that post by Vince about the gunplay and that and anti-gun stance, and also that he had posted something about his missing mother. So you reached out to them on Facebook. You sent them both messages. Did you get a response?
Yes, no, not at that point. So that weekend, I wrote them direct messages. Well, almost immediately, as soon as I found them, I wrote them and I said, I think you know what happened on the Justin B, the name of the boat, back in 1978 when it was sailing down the Belizean coast. I didn't say who I was, and I at that point had a pseudonym, a Facebook account, because I've got three kids and I wanted to keep an eye on them, and I made up this bogus account. So yeah, Facebook might not be too happy, but you know, fake friends in this case were your friend or my friend. So I had this bogus account, and I wrote to them because I didn't obviously want to give my name away as being Farmer. I didn't want to, you know, in case they remembered the names of Chris and Peter. So this worked really well to use this fake account. So I started off by saying, I think you know what happened on that boat back in 1978. And then as the weekend wore on and I got no reply, I became more and more threatening. And by Sunday, I was telling them that there is no way I was going to leave this alone. So they might as well tell me what happened. And because, you know, I was basically going to take it further, which I then did. They didn't reply to me at all. Russell did reply to me, but that was some months later, and when the case had been reopened, and by that point, we were told to have no contact with the boys whatsoever for fear of prejudicing the trial. But what happened after that weekend, after me compiling a whole sort of profile of this family, I went back to Greater Manchester Police, the cold case unit, and basically begged them to see me and present the file and my findings.
You also talked to Michaela Clinch. She contacted David Sachs, and he had a copy of the file with everything in there as well, didn't he?
He did. Yes, he for the 10 months that he was working on the case, he had compiled another set of taken copies of everything. And although he was moved off the case, whenever he came back, he updated his file. He had been writing to Sacramento Police Department, i.e. the letters imploring them to look for Boston. And when he was found in 1981, and on the abduction charge, my father was writing long letters saying, please ask him about this, please ask him about, putting questions basically to the Sacramento police to bring them up to date on what they should be asking, because he was just like a dog with a bone, my father, about this, and wanted to push the case forward. He was desperate. But yes, so Inspector Sachs, when he did come, he was never put back onto the case at all. But he did copy everything that my father was sending, because my father was copying in GMP at that time, Greater Manchester Police.
Now, this you talk about another character, Amy Crosby, and she had been investigating the boy's mother, Mary Lou's, Boston's wife, Mary Lou's disappearance, and at that time she had spoke to Vince. Tell us about what follows these conversations once they do get a chance to speak to Vince. What does he say about the murder of his mother in terms of the knowledge in the family?
Well, I mean, it was a massive revelation to us, because when we went forward and Greater Manchester Police said, yes, we're going to contact Interpol and find out what's happened on the other side of the Atlantic, it was then a couple of months later we heard that the Sacramento police were in contact with Vince and then subsequently Russell. And it was at that point we learned that Vince and Russell, up until that point, we thought, my goodness, these two kids, maybe they hadn't witnessed anything, and we assumed that they hadn't, or whatever had happened to them and maybe happened at night time when the boys were asleep or whatever. But, we did sort of feel bad about the fact that they hadn't come forward and, that the case hadn't been pushed forward, So what was a massive revelation to us was to discover that the boys had been going to law enforcement over the years at various points and trying to tell them that they had witnessed, incredibly, they had been eyewitnesses to their murders. And that was just astonishing news to us, that these two boys had, close quarters witnessed them being murdered. And so Amy Crosby, the detective in Sacramento Police, she had the file on her desk. I think because she was the missing persons detective, she was looking into the case anyway. But another quite extraordinary development, and again, pure coincidence how it all happened in that autumn of 2015, is the fact that the FBI launched this quest to find the Golden State Killer. And they had asked all law enforcement agencies in California to look for cold cases which matched a similar of criminals who had the same modus operandi of tying up and looking for couples.
Now, as a result of that, you say inadvertently it puts this case back on the radar, and things start moving as well. And you get, again, another meeting where, again, we haven't heard the details, but from the eyewitness reports, they ask your family if they, how much do you want to know? What does your family say, and what does your family find out?
Okay, so we were asked to go to Greater Manchester Police one afternoon, and we walked into the room, and the head of the cold case unit there had Russell and Vince's statements that they had given Sacramento PD. And my older brother and I both felt that it was really up to my mother, who at this point was 91 years old. And we said to her, you know, what do you want to know, Mum? Do you want just an edited version, or do you want the whole lot? And she, you know, she'd been waiting for 38 years to find out what had happened to Chris. And, you know, as I say, we are very pragmatic sort of family, and yet she wanted to know everything. And so, yeah, so Martin, the head of the cold case unit, literally went through everything and spared us no detail. And, you know, in a way, it was, I hate using that word closure, because it's not really closure. The pain still continues, but we needed to know. We'd waited so long to know what and why this had happened. And so, yes, by the time we walked out of that room, I think we were stunned, shocked, and I think it surpassed any of our worst nightmares, what Boston had done to Chris and Peter. But we needed to know.
How does the case proceed? You have this horrible account. They have this evidence, this mounting evidence. You talk about a contact with Russell personally, but that is a little bit later. So tell us what the police do with all of this information. Now that they've told you, what do they do?
Okay, so obviously he was ruled out. They wanted his DNA for the GSK because obviously his MO was very similar. They were very keen to DNA him. And I think they were pretty surprised to find that he wasn't the GSK. His DNA didn't come back positive. But they knew that they had a really bad guy here. Russell, who was helping with the police inquiries immensely because he had quite a lot of contact with his father, was very instrumental in providing them with a lot of information. And he sat down and with the police and basically told them about all his crimes. Russell is of the belief that he killed 33 people. And certainly, because Boston had told him so, and other people as well. And certainly his mother, he killed the boy's mother, and obviously Chris and Peter, because they witnessed it. But they sat down, once they ruled him out of the GSK series of murders and rapes, they realized that they had this really bad guy on their hands and that they obviously this time had to do something to prosecute him. So they tried to get the British to prosecute him, but we didn't have the legal, we had to revert back to the laws of 1978, and we didn't have the grounds to extradite, for him to be extradited and for him to stand in this country. But the prosecution team went into full operation and really worked the case. We were, you know, they'd obviously dragged their feet for 38 years, but when it did happen, it happened, you know, and they really came together and they decided that the best way to proceed with the case was to charge him in a federal court, because they could establish that the boat, the Justin B, was a piece of American estate owned by an American. And so, quite unusually for federal courts, he was that they were going to charge him. It was going to be a maritime charge of double murder, and for him to be tried in a federal court. Russell, fortunately, had kept a lot of the possessions, Boston's possessions, and he found the receipt for the boat, proving that Boston had owned the boat. So once he'd found that, we knew we were in business and we could proceed. We felt, very confident because the two boys were willing to stand against their father, and we were very confident that the case would go ahead.
You write that December 1st, 2016, he is arrested and charged with the murders of Chris and PETA. And they think he's in Eureka. And it's up to the responsibility of the FBI to arrest him, but ironically, he had moved to a place called Paradise. What is the state
Yes.
of this person at that time? How old is he, and what kind of condition is he in?
Okay, by then he was 74. His health was failing. He had multiple health issues, heart, lung. He'd lived a pretty rough life because he was on the run for so long, 50 years, if you take it from his wife's murder, 1968. He'd just literally, spent it on the run. So, he was pretty much a vagrant, really. But by then he had gone into this nursing home in Eureka. And, when the FBI went to arrest him, they discovered, much to their dismay and shock, and to our shock, I have to say, because we were told that he was under constant surveillance, he had been moved just a couple of days before. And what was even more astonishing is the reason he'd been moved is that one of the nurses had taken pity on him, obviously not realizing his background, and felt that he needed better care. So he was moved to the nursing home in Paradise. So they quickly scrambled another prosecution team, and he was arrested then on December the 1st, 2016, for Chris and Peter's murders back in 1978.
With this entire case, and again, if you don't want to recall all of this, but if you find out the exact fate from the sons, and also another witness later, Brian Logsdon, is a good friend of Russell, and he was told information that corroborated the story, but what was the reason? You found out the question you asked for 38 years was why? Why? What
yeah.
happened and why? What happened
okay,
and why?
So in 2017, I got all this detail from the cold case unit, but I also heard it firsthand from Russell Boston, who I met in 2017. That basically what had happened was Boston was regularly beating up both sons, particularly Russell, who was just basically a punch bag for him. And one afternoon in late June, my brother had interceded and said, stop beating up Russell, get off. And he had tried to, I think, pull Boston off Russell, who was literally beating him, raining down punches on Russell. And as he did say, Boston, who was drunk, he particularly liked rum, had swung out at my brother, and he missed, and he ended up going into the sea, Boston this is, and he was very humiliated, and it was quite near the coastline, and people on shore could see the altercation and could see that, there was a row had broken, and my brother shouted to him, you can come back on board the boat if you behave. But if you're going to beat up your kids like this, then, you know, you can stay there and cool down, basically. Anyway, Boston assured him that he was going to behave and be good, so my brother helped him back on board. Later that evening, Boston said to Vince, I'm going to kill them for that. I'm fucking going to kill them. You know, I'm humiliated. They're not going to live. Anyway, the next day, as dusk was drawing down, the sun was going down, Boston said to Chris, go and pull up the anchor. And Chris, as he went to pull up the anchor, Boston crept up behind him, and with him in his hand, he had a lead-lined truncheon, one that was no longer in use at that point because of the indiscriminate damage it does to people. So he went up and started hammering down blows at the back of Chris's head. Chris covered his skull for protection with his arms and his hands. Vince says there was blood flying everywhere, all over the deck, and he heard Chris's skull fracture. You know, there was an awful crack. Chris tried to get up, sort of stagger along the deck, and to say, you know, what are you doing? You know, what's your game? What the hell's happening here? And then Boston, who had prepared who had got on the deck a fillet knife to fillet fish with, then stabbed him in the chest, in the sternum, and it was so hard that the handle broke and it flew into the sea. But Peter came up from the galley and said, what's going on? She was shocked, and he told her to get down and threatened her with a spear gun. So after that, basically he tied their hands very loosely, but Chris by this point was in a very bad state. You know, I think he'd got numerous broken bones. He was obviously concussed. I think he was fading in and out of consciousness and, you know, broken skull. One can only imagine how badly injured he was. The reason, and I don't think we've discussed this one, is that the reason Boston was down there was because he was wanted in Sacramento, in Belize, was because he was wanted on a serious rape charge of a minor, and he had escaped justice in Sacramento, which is why he fled with the boys down to Sacramento, down to Belize. So basically, you've got a serial rapist on that boat. Peter was cordoned off and held in this tiny little cabin in the front of the boat, and Chris was kept on deck, tied up with ropes. She was tied up. They were stripped naked. Boston spent some. I will leave up to your imagination without going too far into this. But you know, Peter was alone with Boston for some time in this front cabin, naked, roped up, hogtied, hands behind. But he over the course of, well, Russell says it went on for a good 2 days. Vince says it was less time, but certainly, I mean, Russell says there were two nights where they were in this state. I think Vince says it was one night, but Chris, when it first, after the argument had first broken out and he was badly injured, he said to Boston, you know, what can we do? What you know? And Boston said, well, you haven't paid me. And so Chris said, that's fine. You know, we'll hand over whatever you want from us. And he made them sign some of their Thomas Cook traveler's checks, which they did. And quite incredibly, Chris got from his medical bag, because he was a junior doctor, but Boston was complaining of backache. Wow. So Chris said, I will give you a sedative to so the pain will wear off, which he did. And that first night, Boston slept soundly, apparently. And Chris also injected himself into his collarbone, to release some of the pain that he was in. So it's quite extraordinary, really, because Chris actually did have the wherewithal in his medical bag to put Boston out. Well, he did sedate him, and presumably Chris and Peter could have. I don't know how whether Chris was actually conscious enough to do it. If he injected himself, presumably he could have. But you know, they could have tied Boston up themselves, and you know, incapacitated him. But they chose not to, thinking, I think, that in the morning it would all be fine, and that it was just a mental aberration of Boston's that he'd done this, and that come the morning, all would be fine. But what happened was, you know, the next day he woke up. Russell says that it continued for another 24 hours. Vince says it didn't. But basically what then happened was he said to them that what he was going to do was tie engine parts, heavy engine parts that he was using as ballast to stabilize the boat, and which they had picked up in Dangriga on the trip down. He said he was going to tie them to their limbs, which he did, really heavy engine parts, because what he wanted to do was put them inshore and for them to walk in slowly, but he wouldn't drop them onshore because he didn't want them to alert, you know, the police too soon, and what he wanted to do was take the boat further out to sea so he could escape. So he said he was putting these engine parts on their legs and round their necks in order to slow them down. And he then said he was going to take the boat into shore. At this point, they were both on the deck, trussed up, hogtied, with these engine parts around them. And then, as he was taking them inshore, he said, "Hey, I'm going to put some plastic bags over your heads, but it's okay, it's all right. I'm going to put holes in so you can still breathe, but I just don't want you to see where we're going." So he asked the boys if they would tie them around their heads, and according to the boys, they refused. But all the time, he was trying to make them be accomplices. You know, he was asking Vince and Russell to watch over them during the night, to keep guard over them. He was all the time trying to implicate them in his crime. Remember, they were only 12 and 13. But anyway, he took the boat inshore, and then all of a sudden he decided to go back around and take them out to sea. And at that point, he put plastic bags over their heads. And it was out at sea when they were, well, completely out of their depths. You know, this was some way offshore. He threw Chris overboard, the engine parts, followed by Chris, and then Peter. And again, the two accounts differ, the two boys' accounts differ. You know, Russell says that I think Chris went reasonably quietly because I think he was in such a bad state, and I think he was physically absolutely, you know, he'd had it really by this point. But I think Peter, you know, she was fully aware, and she heard Chris go into the water, and Russell says she was pretty hysterical and didn't go easily at all. And pushed them overboard out at sea, and then continued on sailing. And this was all witnessed by the two boys.
Talk about, too, the psychological torture that was after the physical battering, in that the separation of the couples, but also that right to the very end, he was trying to deceive them, telling them, "Listen, we're right by the shore, so when I dump you off with this heavy engine parts, the ropes will be kind of loose." Russell, lying to Russell in front of them, that the ropes would be so loose that they would just be able to, they'd be walking on the floor of the ocean anyway.
Yeah.
So right, deceiving, and meanwhile, as you write, and this impending horror, Chris doesn't realize till it's too late.
I mean, Chris is an intelligent guy. I think that it was almost like a trap, that it was like a serpent luring them into this trap, And I think once they realized that they were in too deep, there was no turning back. It was a one-way street. I think, you know, they'd gone too far. And I think by this time, they both knew that the game was up. That, well, not, no game, but I think they knew that they were going to die. I think, you know, they as I say, Chris was, and Peter, they were both very intelligent, bright people. And Chris, you know, he didn't just have a scratch. He was very, very badly injured. And, you know, goodness knows what Boston did to Peter.
Yeah. Now back to Dwayne Boston. He's behind bars. He's not going to get any bail. He's sick. So your pursuit of justice, your family's pursuit of justice, your father has passed away by this time, but your mother is still alive. And still, like you say, very aware. And so what happens with this trial?
So we were asked if we wanted to have the death penalty for Boston. But my mother, being the person she is, she has always believed that it's sort of lowering yourself to the level of the gutter, the criminal, and she refused it. And I felt, you know, but my older brother and I just felt that it was very much left. It was my mother's decision what she wanted to do.
Sure.
So we actually said no, we would waiver it. And in any case, you know, practically speaking, he was just going to sit on death row or die on death row anyway. So we said no, that we didn't want it. But yeah, things started moving. But then, you know, he was arrested December 2016, but by February the 14th, we were told that he'd been hospitalized. And it was then that our heart was beginning to sink. But then by the end of February, he was out of hospital again, and we actually started feeling more confident because we were given a provisional court date of October the 6th, I think it was, or October the 8th, and we were asked to go over to Sacramento in early May to give pretrial evidence. So we were quite encouraged by that, you know, and we really felt that we were at last beginning to see justice, you know, that the wheels of justice were actually beginning to turn in our favor after all these extraordinary coincidences, and, you know, that this sort of like jigsaw that had been thrown to every, you know, possible corner of the globe was, that had started to come together almost like in slow motion. We felt, you know, wow, you know, that this court trial was actually going to happen. But then, yeah, in early April, we got bad news.
Yeah. The idea that, tell us how he keeps control right to the end.
Okay, so basically what happened then in early April, I mean, he knew we were coming over for him. You know, we'd actually set this the courts had actually set this pre-trial evidence date of early May, so he knew that we were coming, and you know, we were coming over with the GMP detectives and the detective back from 1978 was coming. My mum and I were coming, and we were all going to come over. And basically, on April the 4th of 2017, Boston said to his doctors, "I want to stop dialysis. I don't want any more medication. I don't want liquid. I don't want food. I don't want anything. I want to die." And apparently, they had to honour that. And extraordinarily, I just couldn't get my head around this. I thought, you know, how can this happen? How can you let him die when we, you know, justice is within our grasp, you know?
Yeah.
But basically, Russell, his next of kin, his younger son, went to see him the day before he died, and he said to his father, "Look, you've killed our mom. We know she's dead. You've admitted to us you've killed her. Please, you know, just tell us where she's buried." And even to the very end, he had this glower, you know, this menacing look, this controlling look, and he just looked at him. He looked down at the shackles on his legs and his arms, because he was shackled in this hospital bed with two marshals either side of him. And he said he didn't say anything. He just absolutely gave him this sort of death look, and as if to say, you have you've basically given evidence against me, Russell. How could you? So Russell got no satisfaction. Russell and Vince got no satisfaction, and we were just devastated. You know, we could not believe we got so far, in the case, and yet we had fallen at this final hurdle. We could not grasp it. It was just like a further kick in the stomach, really, to us, that he was extricating life on his terms, and that he wasn't even going to give us that small crumb of satisfaction. It was never going to bring them back, but it would have meant a lot to have known that, he had gone down for it, but he wasn't going to give us that.
No. Part of the extraordinary part of the book, of a truly extraordinary book, is the interaction with Russell and with you, that Russell has this deathbed interaction with his father, tells him things that he always wanted to tell him, and then you have this incredible meeting with Russell yourself, realizing that he too is a victim, and again, you provide that event that, again, cathartic. You say this cathartic, but a cathartic event where you speak to Russell and talk about that fateful day, those fateful days on that boat with him and PETA. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about Dead in the Water, Bringing Down My Brother's Keeper After His 39 Years on the Run. Tell us where we can get a copy of this book and how we can find out more about this. Do you have a Facebook page, website? Tell us more about how people might find out more about Dead in the Water.
Thank you very much. Yes, well, I'm grateful to you for allowing me to talk for so long. It's available, I think, from just about every bookshop. If you go to my website, www.pennypharma.co.uk, you will see three outlets, Amazon, I think it's Barnes & Noble, and one other that I can't remember right now. But if you go to that anyway, you will see it. But yes, it's launching April the 2nd. Thank you so much for having me. I hope I haven't, sent you all to sleep.
Oh, no, this has been a fascinating interview. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about this very, very personal case. And
yes,
like you say, astonishing that this fight for justice, this your pursuit of justice took so long, but you did bring this, incredibly, you did bring down your brother's killer, brought him to justice, and all of the information about exactly what happened when first you knew nothing, and all that horror of not knowing, and this, again, it's not closure, but this. Thank you very much for this incredible effort and this book, Dead in the Water. I want to thank you very much.
I've just looked, and my website tells me that it's Amazon US, it's Barnes & Noble, and it's IndieBound. So I hope that helps. And the publisher is Diversion Book, so who've been absolutely wonderful and, are very supportive. So, yeah. Anyway, well, thank you so much, and I hope that readers let me know their thoughts, because I've got broad shoulders, and I'd love to hear from people as to what their thoughts are on the case. And as you say, it is just one of those really unbelievable stories, really, that if you read as fiction, you just would not believe. But yeah, I can vouch that every word is true.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Penny Farmer, for talking about Dead in the Water, Bringing Down My Brother's Keeper After His 39 Years on the Run. Join me, fans, on Facebook for comments about this episode and others. Thank you, Penny Farmer. Good night.
Thank you.